You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I am welcoming back the second guest to return. The mighty, mighty Brendan Burns, recorded live at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival 2015. This conversation took place just last weekend, and we are rushing it to you now because it was an awful lot of fun. Here's Brendan Burns.
No one knows why the fuck they did that, do they?
Wow.
That's a wrestling thing.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, what specifically what?
I've almost like inadvertently become the wrestling fan's wrestling fan.
That is not inadvertent. That's a deliberate career shift of yours. You love wrestling and you've been doing everything.
That is true, actually. You know what? Anytime anyone talks about coming out, I now get it. Like, life is so much better when you come out.
Yeah.
For years, I guess I was worried that people would... We're a misunderstood bunch, aren't we? You know, it's like, do you know it's fake? It's like, do you like Star Wars? Get fucked, right? It's the art form that's the most similar to ours.
Yes.
And that's why wrestlers and comedians, those worlds are now really blending.
And the lifestyle as well, isn't it?
You're on the road and you adapt what you do. You have bits, but you adapt it based on the audience response. So you do certain things at certain times.
Are you allowed to be saying this? This isn't kayfabe, is it? I mean, I know much about wrestling, but I know a lot about secrets.
Yeah. Kayfabe means stuff that is a work, you know, in order to get the audience going. And a shoot is something that is real.
Kayfabe is a work. That's an example of using terminology.
Are you translating
to explain terminology?
For me? They understood.
No, absolutely, absolutely. But
I'm sorry, he speaks Australian.
For those of them,
let me translate for you.
No, you were using the term a work.
Yes.
I did, that's terminology as well. So you're using terminology to explain terminology.
A work is something that is, well, I suppose, fake, yes.
Yes, no, exactly.
And kayfabe is actually carny for fake.
Yes, there we are. And you too can attract audience members with pictures of knives on their T-shirts if you would go further down this road. We will talk about the wrestling stuff. We've got loads of stuff to talk about. Do you remember the first conversation that we had a year and a half ago?
Yes, I do.
We talked a lot about... I've written down some of the things we talked about that I felt we didn't finish.
Yes.
And that you may have felt that. Because you emailed me the day after the episode came out.
Yes.
What did you say in that email, Brendan?
I said, you know how I said young English comics can be a bit condescending?
Yes.
And you went, that doesn't happen. And you did exactly that.
Okay, good.
Exactly that. Because how long have you been doing this?
11 years.
Go get me a fucking coffee, right? Because I remember you you broached it to begin with, and the thing is, it's like, you're a good guy, and I reckon you can take this, right? And if you think I'm patronising him, I'm allowed to. It's because you said years ago you'd seen a poster of mine, and you wrote me off. And you said that the poster was, it was me dressed as Conan, with a white lady and a black lady strewn about me like warrior princesses. And on it, it said, there was a bunch of quotes, and at the end of it, it said, what was it?
The quote was, all other quotes that you'll see on all other posters at this festival are massaged truths, half lies and outright lies. Mine are the only real quotes. And then it had all your quotes.
No, I said, these are the real quotes. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I'm not that paraphrasing.
But you've missed a part of the joke.
Okay.
Is that the quotes I put were negative. So effectively, I told a joke that sailed over your head.
Yes, yeah.
And yet you, as a young new English comic, still had the balls to go, well, I write this guy off.
Ah, now, at the time, when Mine's I saw that
black.
Poster...
Anyway.
When I saw that poster, I wasn't a comic, and I was trying to explain
well,
on the podcast...
Well, that's even fucking worse!
I was trying to explain on the podcast that I, as a punter, had written you off because of the bluster of the outward appearance of yes. what you were kind of projecting as Brendan, what we talked about at the time as being the leather jacket and bandana Brendan, and I'd said that as a punter, I'd found it easy to go, oh, I think I know what this is going to be. So and I was then, explaining that I was wrong.
Oh, I see. So, but not later as a comic were you going like, but now I get it. What were you saying?
I was saying that the, you know what I was saying. I was saying I wrote you off. What it boiled down to, the conversation we were having was about the fact that in your comedy youth, in your earlier years as a comic, you had been the wild-eyed loner very deliberately. You were going, I'm a leather jacket, I'm Mad Max was the analogy we used at the time.
Have you seen, I went back and watched Mad Max 2 recently.
I'm glad we're getting to the nub of the...
No, have you seen it? It's the most illegal movie in history. It's an insurance fucking nightmare. Because the first one, I mean, my mate made a joke about Mad Max 2 is all they did was they stuck up CCTV cameras in the Australian outback and filmed for exactly 2 hours. But Mad Max 2 is, it's amazing. Go back and play the drinking game during Mad Max 2 because what is the basis of the movie is it's a post-apocalyptic nightmare. And all it is we're low on petrol.
Yeah.
That's now. But go and watch Mad Max 2 and play the drinking game. What every time they waste petrol, they spend the entire movie wasting petrol. They're on motorbikes doing fucking donuts at night. They use petrol as a weapon because they set fire to it. And then the big twist at the end is, of course, they've got the truck. Right, that's another waste of petrol. Right, and that's the decoy because it's filled with sand. And then the actual oil refinery, they blow that up. There's another waste of petrol, but their big plan of like, we're going to paradise, there's this entire different world away. It's Queensland, right? And it's all their head petrol's in a bus, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Watch the end of the movie. There's four barrels. There's four barrels of petrol, and the rest they blew up.
And I believe the conversation we had last time tried to separate the bombastic shouting Brendan that likes to change the subject from the thoughtful, wise, intelligent Brendan that at the time I suggested hadn't been allowed to get out.
That's not true.
No?
No. I think...
Because if it's not true, that's fine. We can bounce off that because the main thing we were talking about last time was condescension. And you're accusing me of that, and I understand that.
Yes, so, I mean, yeah, in hindsight, when you said, like, I wrote you off, I was like, it's not your place to write me off.
I meant as a punter, looking at a poster and deciding whether or not to see that show, I went, oh, this is just big, loud, in your face, look how dangerous and exciting I am.
Ah, so I misunderstood.
I see, understand, fine.
All right, but, then. There we go. All right, good night.
The grudge match settled. But I thought we could start that because we didn't get... We started to chip away at that. And you were talking about your sense in comedy that there is us versus them. And your sense that... And I can see I'm going to need to remind you of some things you said very passionately last time. And you say a lot of things...
Oh, I can commit to anything. I have now committed to just letting the crazy moron speak.
Okay, okay.
Well, because I think we addressed that last time as well. One of the issues I see in British comedy is people are too bogged down with whether they think you're clever enough or a decent enough person.
Yes.
But the fact that this whole idea that comedy is truth, it's not. It's preposterous notions. And then Jerry Seinfeld put it very well in his Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee.
Never heard of it.
Because he said comedy is all about proofs. Is you put forward a preposterous notion and then you prove it.
Yes.
And somewhere, I think we got too bogged down and preoccupied with intelligence versus funny. And the worst thing that can happen to comedy is worrying about whether people think you're clever enough or not.
Okay. So let's look at that idea of proof and of proving things and of the agency that you have. I think you have tremendous agency on stage to say the world is like this or the world is like that. And that's something I really struggle with. I was having a conversation with a comic called Finn Taylor last night, a newer comic, and he says something he's doing at the moment that he's finding really useful is realising that you don't have to mean what you say.
That's right.
You can come up with a two-dimensional version of yourself. And I was, and he was kind of arguing with me, going, "That it's just that." And I was going, "No, but I can't do that. I find it incredibly difficult." But I personally, the comic Stu Goldsmith, I find it very hard to go, "Oh, I know how my persona would react to that." You know, if there's a beach ball, I know how Frankie Boyle is going to think about that. I know how Russell Brand is going to think about that. I don't know how I would think about that.
For me, I think I've always found the funny in being very serious about the stupid and very stupid about the serious. And I think, like, sometimes I've noticed now as well, like, say when someone goes, "Oh, I'm going to do politics now." And then sometimes, like, say you're closer to my age, right? And there's a 27-year-old kid going, "I'm going to tell you about politics now." You fucking shut down, don't you? You go, like, "Shut the fuck up. I don't give half a fat rat's ass what you think yet, young man. You know what? Just dance like a monkey for me." And so sometimes I can argue either side of a coin, no matter which way it flips. But also, yeah, I've kind of committed now. I've let go of a lot of stuff.
What kind of stuff have you let go of? Because I was really interested last time to see the difference between the kind of Road Warrior comic that I was talking about in the posters, and Road Warrior is a Mad Max reference, to see the difference between that and the reflective kind of post-rehab Brendan, who is calmer and much more zen. And you were, you know, there's a real... You've got so much energy and anger and fire... But I was listening in the car on the way up here to episode 10 of the Brendan Burns Show podcast, in which I want my $100 back. That one. We can get into that in more detail. But I recommend that to anyone listening. It's fascinating, and to hear you playing back details of a gig where playing back the recording of a gig where you were heckled by someone, tore into them. They tore into you. You bet them $20 you could win them over. You failed. And then, but you, and I don't want to give away what happens in it, because it's a brilliant story. It's a really interesting
story. I only had $100 in my pocket.
Yeah. So.
But then it turns out, I went back to the recording, and it turns out she was fucking lying.
Well,
so I want my fucking $100 back.
I don't.
See, I can get it anywhere. You can just reach for it any time.
Well, that's it. I was listening to that, and I was thinking, okay, so how much of this, when the quiet, reflective Brendan listening back to something and going, "Oh, actually," like, you did a lot of defending her. In that podcast, you say...
I had to defend her to the room. They were ready to kill her.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In the podcast, you defend her a lot, and you say, "Now, listen, to give her the benefit of the doubt," and you're much sort of wiser and quieter. So let's just, before we sort of end up talking more about that podcast, I don't want to get too meta here, but let's look at the difference between the fiery, youthful Brendan and the more reflective Brendan. You said you had to let go of a lot of things. What sort of things?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think... I think people that have been following us for years actually always knew there was more going on. So actually in a solo show, if you came to see me and if you paid money, good money to see me, I've always been gracious and grateful for that, right? I've, however, never reacted well to people sitting with folded arms judging. So somewhere... So often when people would describe me as that firebrand or the offensive or the angry or whatever, I think most people that actually were really familiar with what I did would go, "No, he's emotive. He's emotional."
Yes.
But anger is the easiest one to tap into.
Yes.
However, if you were to see me at a late night gig at Late and Live and the audience are just a bunch of baying scum,
yep.
I'm responsive. I'm going to react that way. So if they're going to be baying scum, I'm going to be a bigger paying scum.
Okay.
Whereas if you come along and you're a fan and you've paid your hard-earned money to come and and listen to what I have to say, then that's always been different from the public perception.
When you describe the frustration in one of your own shows, even, of seeing someone in the audience with their arms folded, and I'm aware now people are becoming very self-conscious. But when you see someone with their arms folded, like I might see that, or another comic, any comic, might see that and go, "I have to win that person over." And you see that and go, "I'm not fucking having that."
Yeah.
So where does that come
from? The Free
Fringe
is fucking awesome. The Free Fringe, you can kick people out. At the top of the show, like, because...
the top of the show, pre-select them.
Oh, yeah, totally. Like, if they're an arsehole, there was a bunch of stag lads, and I was like, look, my show isn't listed where it said it was, right? It's there's no posters, no flyers. I've one listing in the Fringe Guide. It's nothing but diehard fans. I've been doing this for 25 years. You don't have the right to be a cunt. Get out of my room. Or I actually, like, if someone's sitting there being horrible and judgy, I, like, reached into their pocket and stole, like, 20 pounds. But I showed a video last year of doing that, and the funniest thing was a guy was doing it the following night. So I had a video of me doing that, uploaded it on YouTube, and then a guy was sitting there like that, and I went, you don't get to be a motherfucker. And I ran into reaching into his pocket, and as I'm reaching in his pocket, he went, oh, fuck, I saw the video and everything.
That's lovely.
I was like, all right, keep your 20 quid.
That's lovely. But I
because, mean... well, here we go, right? Like, at the Fringe, there's three, I now understand audience entitlement, particularly at the Fringe, because there was 3,000 shows that you could have gone to see. And you've got, like, people hassling you all day and giving you a flyer and going, this guy's the greatest thing since fucking sliced bread. He's the funniest thing. He's the next whatever. Yada, yep. Yada, yada. Yep. And you had 3,000 choices and someone bullied you into going into the room. Then you go into the room and that guy couldn't buy a laugh off you. Mm-hmm. Right? I'm now on that audience's side. Okay. I am now stepping out of that game. Because
okay. Do you mean now in terms of, like, after so many years of doing comedy, now you kind of appreciate that?
It's like, my argument is, I saw Spider-Man 3. And if Sam Raimi was in the building, I would have gone up to him afterwards and gone, it's fucking Venom! How do you fuck up Venom? It's like, it's not even you even had to come up with the story. You had storyboards. $100 million, you fucking cunt. I would have gone nuts at that guy.
I feel your pain. I know you.
It's like there were storyboards. Yeah. It wasn't just like, oh, you're adapting from a book. They even had the fucking shots for you.
I love the idea of the book of Spider-Man 3. The man was muscly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah.
And then you've got, like, the whole Secret Wars story. I'm so glad that you understand exactly where I'm going. And I love that this room is tuned into that. So that's what I mean. So if then all of a sudden someone, I've spent 50 grand on promotion and there's big posters all over Edinburgh and, like you made fun of like declaring myself a genius and incidentally... Every time a comedian does that, they pick that quote. I ought to know because I did it for 10 years. And so now, without bullying anyone into coming, now through, podcasting and having online content, now I'm just starting to reach out to the people that speak my language of funny.
Yes.
And so then it's this whole tour I've been doing. The outside the box tour,
yeah.
Which is effectively I'm playing anything but comedy clubs. So I mean, I did a gig in someone's kitchen the other night. It was awesome. Mm-hmm. That was probably the venue more than any other. That as I was turning up with the audience, it's someone's driveway in the middle of suburban Wolverhampton. And me and the audience are just all looking at one another going, is this it? This can't be it.
That's great. I love the idea of, like, a gig in someone's kitchen is one thing, hypothetically. As soon as you say the word Wolverhampton, that's a very real situation.
Yes, it is. Yeah, exactly, because you're driving in suburban Wolverhampton. And, I mean, there's not even a corner store, you know? And so we really, like, we're, like, looking... And then there's this mood of, like, we found it. And there's already, like, this secret handshake between me and them. And because I realised, like, I'm hearing horror stories from the comedy circuit that there's 110 shows on tour right now. I'm so sorry, that burp must have been really hideous.
I don't think we really noticed it, but we'll be able to listen back.
But I actually, like, coned it. So I was hiding it from you, but really just projecting it to the podcast. You could probably smell the monster in that. This is like a scratch and sniff podcast.
Stick to the point, Brendan. We've got limited time.
Okay.
I want to direct people to the outside the box tour that you're doing, and I want us to talk about that. But before we get onto it, I want to talk about. Yeah, obviously you are now attracting your own crowd, and you are not bullying them with posters and stuff.
So imagine this. Imagine this. Imagine an Edinburgh festival where you didn't ring your PR once, where you didn't ring your promoter once, where you didn't look at someone else's poster and wonder why yours wasn't there. But above all, and this is just priceless to me, imagine a tour and a festival with no arguments.
Arguments with whom? With punters?
With punters.
Yeah.
With no one coming up afterwards outraged.
Yeah.
You know, because I haven't...
That's the echo of that burp, by the way, if anyone's just...
Was that you blowing your nose? I really thought it was a chair moving. But at first, when I thought it also added gravitas. When I said, like, imagine a festival with no arguments. And then there was this, and I thought it was a, like a guy that didn't know what noise to make at the end. But yeah, but it came out,
So are we to extrapolate from this that normally at your festival shows you have loads of arguments?
Absolutely.
Because that's not typical of every comedian.
Isn't it?
I mean, there's two ways we could look at this. Either I'm extraordinarily bland and never cause any offence, or you create more arguments than most.
Maybe. Wow, that was short, wasn't it? Yeah, because I mean, we talk about the nature of offence. It's come up so much as of late, and it's like that whole dapper laughs thing, and comedians are celebrating the fact that this guy is now getting ITC. First of all, it was shit. He's not a skilled comic. That was all. He's just new.
Yeah.
Right? And, okay, he would have got taken off the air, but then there's this huge furore, and then, like, he's on Newsnight?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, how can she sit there and take herself seriously, like, going, now what do you think? You're interviewing Dapper fucking laughs. Like, forget him. Like, you've effectively, someone's pulled their pants down, and you're going, look at you with your pants down.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't mock someone with their pants around their ankles. And then comedians are like, yeah, there was an ITC, and people were celebrating like it was a victory for them. I've been around a long time. I know how this ends.
Go on.
And it's cyclical, and it just ends up with comedy in the hands of people with no sense of humour.
Yeah.
They start running things, you know? And not only that, it's... John Safran put it very well. He's an Australian documentary maker and satirist. And he said, comedians don't realise that you've created the golem. And in the end, the golem eats you.
So this is Brendan, and as you can hear, we got stuck in much the same fashion as we did last time. I very much enjoyed this. What we discover later on in the episode, I don't want to preempt it too much, but Brendan talks about his petulance and as a younger comic, his petulance. And I think it is fascinating seeing someone who's obviously been going for so long, as he says, 25 years, who's able to look back with a real forensic kind of analysis of who he was then and who he is now. And it's fascinating. It's endlessly fascinating to me to hear bits of old Brendan creep back into new Brendan's patterns of speech and opinions and so forth. And I just think he's such a good guy. And he's, I mean, obviously it goes without saying, a terrific comic. But I just find him very, very easy to talk to. So I hope he will return again someday. You can catch Brendan on his Outside the Box tour, which we'll be talking about in a little bit, at various venues all over the country. Anything that isn't a proper a comedy venue. So the tour is still ongoing, and you can go to thebrendanburnsshow.com. That's www.thebrendanburnsshow.com for more information on that. And for more information on his podcast, as we go on to discuss Brendan and Luke's Outback Adventures. It seems he's quite... Brendan's approach for his podcast is brilliant because it's whatever he's doing at the time. So there's kind of mini-series within it. And as you'll hear, some really fun stuff where he's playing gigs of... he's playing his own deaths. And that is absolutely... I started at episode 10 because it caught my eye. I really recommend you listen to that one if you're a fan of Brendan, as I'm sure you are. And also, Brendan emailed me after the show, not this time to tell me off for condescending to him, but to remind me, as a reminder for himself, that he would like to include shout-outs to some wrestlers who apparently listen to this show. So hello and lots of, I don't know what, I was going to say lots of love. You can't say that to a wrestler. Yeah, you can. Wrestlers need love too. Lots of love to Wade Barrett, to William Regal, Colt Cabana, who I met a couple of years ago at the festival, Mick Foley. And Matt, I'm going to go with Sidal, like as in Von Sidal, Matt Sidal, I think. And this is brackets formerly Evan Bourne, which may be some sort of wrestling insider in joke, or it might just be that his name's changed. Who knows? So lots of love to all of those guys. And also in a fifth email that I got from Brendan that night, he told me, and this cannot be true,
If Rowdy Roddy Piper is listening to this, please send me a tweet at ComComPod. I would love to hear from Rowdy Roddy Piper. Apparently, as we mentioned briefly, there's lots of similarities in the lifestyle of wrestlers and comics. And apparently lots of wrestlers are listeners fans of British and old comedy. And some of them might well listen to this show. So hello there, wrestlers. Get in touch. If you're any of those guys or you are Rowdy Roddy Piper, please get in touch with me at ComComPod. Or even if you're not, if you're another wrestler. And that goes absolutely the same for drag queens. As you know, huge fan of Latrice Royale, Sharon Needles, and RuPaul's Drag Race in general. And my girlfriend and I, big announcement coming on that, by the way, we're very lucky to see RuPaul's Drag Race Battle of the Seasons, hosted by Bianca Del Rio. Bianca Del Rio, absolutely fantastic drag queen and insult comic. Very, very funny. So search for Bianca's web series online. We were very lucky that she stood in last minute for Michelle Visage at the RuPaul's Drag Race Battle of the Seasons at the Ballroom in San Francisco. Bianca was hilarious. And if anyone is listening to this who knows her, or him, obviously it's a him, but in drag parlance, her, please ask Bianca to come on the show next time she's in the UK. I would absolutely love to interview Bianca, not just as a drag act, but as a very, very funny, scathing, improvisational comedian. So while we're doing shout-outs, let's include a bunch of those as well. And also, hello to Jinx Monsoon, if you happen to be listening. Great fun working with Jinx in Christchurch. That's all the blather. Now, listen, this is a big announcement. I sort of you might notice this almost came up in the interview I did with Lou Sanders. Thank you for your reactions to that. That one's gone down very well, but big fan of Lou. Had a really interesting conversation. That was the previous episode, 110, I think it was. I mentioned something and then I got cold feet about announcing it. But this is the announcement. I got engaged. I'm getting married and I'm super happy about it. And I'm very happy. I don't know why I was cagey about telling anyone. We've been through this process of sort of not telling people that you do. You know, you sort of tell family and then you tell close friends and then you tell wider friends and then you make it publicly available on Facebook and so forth. I just thought I'd tell you. I'm super happy. And there's the engagement story is probably for another time. It might end up being part of this year's show, so I won't spill the beans entirely. But it was a phenomenally gay proposal process outside the former site of Castro Cameras in the Castro district of San Francisco, where the pedestrian crossings are literally rainbows. They're not literally rainbows. They're literally rainbow coloured. There's that. I'm sort of making that as if that's an announcement. I'm thrilled. She seems happy enough. Hooray for love. Last thing before we go back into Brendan. I mentioned, in fact, at the beginning of this conversation with Brendan, I mentioned stand-up comic, UK comic Finn Taylor, who is taking his second hour to Edinburgh this year. He's released his first hour, and I thought I'd advertise it. It's a free download. Yes, it's right. It is completely free. There is a clip on YouTube, which I will put on the Twitter feed at ComComPod and in the Facebook Comedian podcast group. And also you can download it by going to www.finntaylor.com/downloads. It's completely free. I am a huge fan of Finn's. I'll get him on the show before long. But his hour is absolutely superb. I saw him doing new stuff and he's knocked it up a gear even since then. So you'll be hearing a lot about Finn. But you can get his album completely free. So go along and do that. It's finntaylor.com/downloads. Thank you for listening. Let's get back to Brendan. Please remember, if you fancy donating to the show, you can do that at comedianscomedian.com. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com. And as Brendan and I discuss, finding one's own audience, cultivating that audience online is such a big part of how contemporary comedy works now. And I'm very, very lucky to have the support of all of you guys. And thanks. Remember to rate the show on iTunes. Every so often that occurs to me. Oh, I should tell people to rate it. I think that sort of helps getting noticed somehow. So bung a 5-star rating on iTunes if you fancy. And you can write some nice words there as well if you'd like, which might convince other people to get involved. And of course, you can donate £20, a one-off donation of £20, £1 a show, or whatever you think is most appropriate. You can donate that via PayPal. And I promise, I swear down, by the end of this year, there will be the means to... By the end of this year, how much grace am I giving myself? There will be the means to set up some sort of regular payment, something like that. We'll get more sophisticated when the new website comes out, which will happen very soon. Let's get back to Brendan.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, looking at from you on stage, looking out at punters who previously have folded their arms, and that's pissed you off. Like, that's not something you're suffering on this tour now,
because no.
you're being very, very selective. You're only getting people. You're doing that thing of cultivating
also,
a very specific audience.
On top of that, better yet, like Greg Proop said it as well, didn't he? That people say that stand-up is the most intimate art form.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
it's not anymore, because podcasts
are. Podcasting, yeah.
Because it's a conversation. So now, not only are they into what I do, they have a backstory.
Mm-hmm.
I am continuing a conversation
they've
from
shared,
a podcast.
They've shared baths with you.
Yes. And yeah. And we now
and are doing so now, we can only imagine.
Yeah, because people. I think people don't understand that when a joke can be deemed offensive by some people, people don't understand the love and trust and understanding you are showing them by taking that risk.
Yes.
Because no one sets out to offend a room full of people. They really don't. Maybe I did while
you
I was
You did,
up.
I was going to say.
Maybe I did, but that's because the room had offended me first, right? And I was a very petulant, coked up young man, right?
Okay.
And I'll be the first to put my hand up to that. But really, at the end of the day, no one really is looking out to do that. The simple, every comedian's motivation when they tell a joke is to surprise you into laughing and releasing endorphins so you have a nice night out. Mm-hmm. That is everyone's basic chemical, biological need to do this, and they need to do that because they need love from strangers due to poor parenting or whatever it is.
Yep.
They were either molested or like it was a bad dad or a bad mum. Right? That, by the way, I know you're thinking they're like, oh, is he trying to make a joke of that? No, that's literally the three things that make a comic.
So when you see someone folding their arms in the audience and are unable to move on without digging into them, what is it in you? What is that satisfying in you that you would attack someone who, as you say, has been convinced by advertising and taken a punt on it? Because I'm, you know, that whole thing of like, can you ever blame the audience? From my point of view, I always think you can't blame the audience, except sometimes you can because you've got to let yourself, because otherwise you'd go mental. But you,
I can. I've been doing this 25 fucking years. I know more about comedy than comedy audiences. I understand the psychology of funny better than the average man on the street.
Now, that is incredible to me. Yeah, obviously you do.
I've got 8 albums, 3 specials, and a book on the fucking subject.
All currently available online, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, there you go.
But I agree. You know more about the concept of it. You know more. You're more experienced. But in that one moment of some punter sitting in the audience, he knows more about the experience he's having than you do.
Absolutely. And I'm on his side. I'm on his side if I talked him into coming. But now I'm being so off the grid, I'm not going to comedy
that
club.
He's seeking you out, so you didn't talk him into coming.
Yeah.
So you don't need to...
And my facial recognition is, like, almost autistic. It really is.
Okay.
Like, I actually recognise, like, I have, the joke is I'm so painfully unfamous I recognise my audience. But also, I'm so painfully unfamous, I recognise a guy who keeps getting dragged along by his friends in an attempt to convert him, who fucking hates me. Hates me. And there's something about my voice that it's just this, when will this convict prick shut the fuck up? And every third or fourth joke, his friends will nudge him and go, how about now? And he's like, nah, I still fucking hate him. And he's so committed to hating my guts that I've... Because the thing is, he'll sit there like... And I'll go, hang on, you're the guy that hates me. And then he pisses himself laughing. So I can't dismiss him as having no sense of humour.
Yes.
Because I've seen him laugh at his own discomfort 5 times. And wait for this, at 2 DVD recordings. So that's such a commitment to hating my guts that I think he knows that I'm going to be in the editing suite and I'm looking at this guy and he's almost just like, fuck you. You shouldn't be making this.
In many respects, because of the nature of some of your more recent shows, already a little bit, I'm like, you're the boy who cried wolf here. This is an incredibly long setup where this guy eventually murders you and then it turns out it was part of a show.
I'm always looking for perfect narratives.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I was so guilty of that. Of my kid and I, because my son's 15 now, haven't discussed him in my act for a long time because he's also the little English kid in an Aussie school. And that's like you get your ass kicked for that, right? And also you get put up a year. it's because our summer is different. You pack of wankers. Shame on you. See, that's how ready I am. I knew what that was about.
It's good.
And and it was a very, very kind of tense thing. And I've always been like, but around the teen years, I'm very, very mindful of using him as a comedy prop. I never want him to feel used just as something to be pulled for comedy, right? So I haven't discussed him in my act for about 3 years. And then I went out there.
That was just a funny sentence that I'm very mindful of him feeling like that. So I haven't discussed him for about 3 years or so.
Yeah. Oh, because it got brought up, which is a longer story.
Yeah.
But so I thought, oh, right, that's like I learned my lesson. I went, oh, okay, you know, I better watch this. And then I was in Australia and he asked if he could be on my podcast. And I was like, whoa, really? Like, fuck yes. Like, you know, I'd love to make something with him. And then we got a camper van from a camper van company that wants you to relocate camper vans from city to city, and you get a free camper van. And so we drove across the Australian outback together, and I thought it was going to be like three parts or whatever. Mm-hmm. Ended up being seven, and because you know how we discussed this before, when you're interviewing a friend you've known for years on a podcast, you find out shit you didn't know. So who better than my 15-year-old kid? Because those of you that have teenagers, you know that Skyping is just... But then you all of a sudden stick your pair of you in a car for like 5 days in a race against time. And of course, not only that, he's a little English kid. And I mean, it's the fucking Wild West Australia. Yeah. It's broom to cans. Okay, I know that means nothing to you, but to put it in perspective, day one, we saw a bulldog with a smashed in face.
I look forward to listening to those episodes, and I know that you are generating loads of stuff.
So to your point,
go on.
I tried to get a perfect narrative.
Yes.
So I tried to tie it all up in the end, and he was like you, just going, stop it. Our relationship isn't over, Dad. You know, it's like the only way this fucking has a perfect narrative is one of us fucking dies. So yeah. Shut the fuck up, Dad.
He sort of has to kill you, doesn't he?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. So listen... One of the things we left out, and that was notable by its absence in our last conversation, was you were talking about the art and the science of comedy, and it occurs to me we've talked far and wide about the art of it, but I would like to ask you about the science of it and your technique and how you write, and I'd like because we that's something I talked to a lot of my guests about, and we haven't touched that.
Yeah.
So if we can rein it in from the Thunderdome anecdotal stuff.
That was in America, though, Thunderdome.
Was it?
Yeah.
I wasn't paying that much attention to it. So I just want to talk to you about how you started off writing, because you have now created... I mean, let's mention the specials. You're selling 8 DVDs currently in a bundle on your...
Eight albums, three specials. I cut myself.
Yeah, so this
then there's another three.
So you have
that
written
on DVD.
Hours and hours and hours. What, 15, 20 hours, including all the stuff that didn't
easily
make it to the final edit? You must have written, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours.
Well,
and
that's what I've been doing with the podcast now as well, is I keep travelling around the world and I write stuff based on where I am, and then it's gone forever.
Mm-hmm.
So now, it's funny how these things morph into what they're going to be. You don't really know when you start, do you? And in the end, it's like a lot of people are worried about burning material. And then I thought, like, I'm in a different country, like, you know, every other month. And I'm writing a new 20 minutes based on whatever happens in that country.
Yeah.
So I'm taping that stuff because, I think I touched upon it last time. What's the point of being prolific without posterity?
You certainly said a lot of sentences that had that rhythm.
Right. But that makes sense.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And I'm like, I'm sure I've used the right words.
Yeah, no, you did. What's the point of being prolific without posterity?
Yeah.
Posterity, forgive me. So, yes, you make loads of stuff. You want it to last. You want there to be a legacy.
Yes.
You want the stuff to be lasting.
Yeah.
Is it more important to you that the that the jokes are handed down, you know, in the way that we all know Woody Allen jokes, you know, and or Richard Pryor jokes that are kind of like, oh, those have legacy.
That is important to me, because sometimes I see old stuff of mine turning up.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what happens when you go long enough and you write enough.
Okay.
But sometimes you kind of go like, oh, hang on.
Like enough stuff that you think that couldn't just be coincidence. Enough stuff that you go, oh, wow, someone's lifted one of my DVDs and not realised I'm still alive.
No, I think it's lateral. It's collective lateral thinking.
Okay.
It's similar thinking. But also, like, I think trends tend to have a cycle of somewhere between 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff just comes back around and becomes relevant again.
Sure.
And it's almost like you go like, yeah, all right, I did that a while ago.
Okay.
And part of you wants to go like, why doesn't anyone know? Mm.
Oh, yeah, I was saying this.
Do I have to die of cancer?
I was saying this yesterday. I saw a couple of years ago in a service station, I saw a guy, a biker, who had a high-vis jacket and camouflage trousers. And I was like, oh, make your mind up. And then as I saw it, I was like, "That I know that that's been done. I know that I've heard that joke somewhere. But here's me seeing the actual thing."
Yeah, what was it? Patton Oswalt said, life is hack.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, because sometimes, you know, life just writes it. And I've actually had friends who I've been to a show of theirs and they've had a similar experience, and I've had to let them know before they go to DVD, listen, that's actually word for word mine.
Really?
And you've remembered it. I know in my heart and soul they're not thieves.
Yes, of course.
I've just said, look, that's actually mine word for word. You've heard me do it. But also, it's recorded. And it's released. And
how have they taken that?
Great.
Yeah, because you just go, it's
you're
on
doing
the DVD,
them a favor.
And they go, holy shit, I didn't realise.
Yeah, rather than fucking, hey, because there's people that think that they came out with everything. There's nothing new under the sun, right? But also sometimes you can broach it and go, look, this is out there and it's on a recording of mine and this could, you know, a bad friend would let you just go and do that and have your reputation tarnished. Mm-hmm. And the response has always been, wow, that's a, you know what, that is a good friend.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
I remember being at Battersea, I think, Camden Jonglers, and comics A and B were switching with Bo. And comic B got there after opening Bo, and the sound guy said, comic A did three of your lines. He did that one, and that one. And comic B was like, oh, I can't believe it. And then he thought, oh, well, when comic A goes to close the bow gig, then no one's going to tell him in advance.
Who's comic A and comic B?
I'm not going to tell you.
Why? Name names.
I want to talk about the writing. How did you start writing? What did you do? Did you keep notes? Have you always been a kind of a conversational?
Actually, yeah, from day, it kind of went back and forth when I started. Before my first gig, I actually wrote out my act.
Go on.
And it still exists.
Does it?
Yeah.
Where? Is it available as a downloadable extra on the bundle?
No, you know what? I should do that. That would be fucking hilarious.
That would be great.
That's what I do like doing on the podcast.
So you wrote it out long form. You wrote out all of it.
If you notice, like, on the podcast, I have no problems with playing the audio of me bombing horribly.
Yeah, it's great. It's one of the best bits.
I don't know. People know what it's like when I do well. And I think people like you. They like to watch people not liking you.
I mean,
you.
It would be really good to release a special that was cut together from
just
you bombing
fucking
in loads
bombing.
Of different rooms.
Oh, mate.
Someone's got to do it. It might as well be you, man.
Oh, man. I love tearing apart my old act. I get a big kick out. But
so let's look
it's
at
a,
that.
No, it's a written folder. Okay. And it was with my comic book collection. Mm-hmm. And I just like, and I went under it. And then there's just this red file. And
Sam Raimi could just direct your DVD. Sorry.
Yeah. I flipped open the folder and it was just, oh, the bullet points alone.
Go on. So can you give us an example of one or what the thinking was at the time or what you think the thinking was?
First opening line I ever wrote was, I was in a building that was on fire and being the... Because you know how you always add detail without actually funny segue?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you watch comedians segue and you think, oh, I should just put in loads of extra detail. That's how jokes go. So it was so laboured. I was in a building that was on fire the other day, and being the crazy spontaneous guy that I am, what? I went up to the fire alarm and said, in case of fire, break glass. So I smashed all the windows and burnt to death.
Okay, nice. There's a joke in there.
No, maybe I was ahead of my time. That's the first time that's ever got a laugh, I must admit. And I don't know whether it's derisory or...
No, there's a joke in there. Yeah, in case of fire break glass.
And my other opening line used to be, I was feeling the other day. Every now and then I feel a bit I was also very hyperactive and I would jump up and down and do the splits. And going, every now and then I'm feeling And sometimes I'm walking down the street and I just go, And that's why some people call me a dickhead. But wow. I'd jump up, do splits. I would make such a meal of it. I would do it for like 2 minutes, bugging the shit out of the room.
And the punchline was, and that's why some people call me a dickhead.
Yeah.
Wow. And so did you then go on and do that?
I wrote that down. I wrote that fucking down.
How many outings?
On a word processor. I actually typed... brackets, does splits in air. I'd forgotten all about this.
You can, I mean, it's easy to kick young Brendan now from this perspective.
Oh, of
presumably
course.
Presumably at the time you were thinking this will help somehow to write it out. Maybe I'll get other ideas along the way.
No, I think at 19 when you're starting to do stand-up, and this is also back in those days, remember, like, I was the only 19-year-old guy. There was no young people doing it at all. Everyone got into it in their 30s. So, first of all, you know, I'd done a couple of concert at school, got laughs, done a couple of speeches at family events, killed. So I thought, Eddie Murphy was 23 when he went in, did that gig in Washington. So fucking 4 years, I'm going to take this fucking industry by storm.
Okay.
And boy, did my first gig let me know that wasn't true.
I remember, well, we talked last time about your first gig, but let's keep it to the writing.
Yeah.
So you wrote that down, what, in like for posterity or just to, like you were working on it at the time?
I was working on it on
a word processor.
Yes, and then while I was writing, I would come up with stuff.
Okay.
And now it's more like I have an idea and then I just start talking on stage.
Okay.
And sometimes something will prick up in me. Someone in the room will instill something in me and I will go, oh, have you ever... Like last night, this was born of a riff. This is disgusting, by the way. I was talking to two guys that were closer to my age and we were talking about being married to slightly younger women and you don't get... Your erections aren't what they used to be, effectively. I woke up... It started like this because I woke up like just 3 days ago and all of a sudden... I'm that old cunt because I was at the Electric Cinema and the young hipster projectionist that I still look at and think like, oh, there's my generation, right? And he goes, oh, you've grown out the beard, right? You're rocking that look. You look different from the photos. And I said, yeah. And he goes, wow. And he wasn't being insulting. Bear this in mind, this was what hurt so much. It was face value. He goes, wow, you know what? I guess Rolf is locked up now. And... I thought I had lead singer of Clutch going. So I talk about this like at the podcast recording and then it turns into a bit. I'm talking to these two older guys about morning erections and the fact that, you know, my wife is younger than me and hornier than I am and sometimes a morning erection, she'll go to jump on it, but she doesn't realise that the only reason it's there is because I've got a rock hard shit pushing on my prostate. So I've effectively got an erection powered by fecal matter. I've effectively got a dick made of shit pushing inside me, giving me that boner, and she wants to jump on it. I'm like, you don't want any of this, honey. This is... And okay. So that was, like, just pure not... Remember how, like, last time we discussed, like, the first time you step on stage is the most honest you'll ever be?
Yeah, yeah.
And then when that doesn't work, you develop a mask.
Okay.
And then you spend the next, you know, and you build that mask up over 10 years and you go, this is what works. And then you start to get a bit frustrated and you don't really know what it is and it's because you're not being true to yourself. So then you spend the next 10 years peeling that mask away.
Yes.
And now I like
to think... We didn't say that last time, but that's great. Thank you. Yeah, great.
But so now I feel through the online content and through reaching... I knew in my heart there was people that spoke my language. And now that they're in, I've... feel totally unself-conscious on stage.
Okay.
So last night, all of that just came spewing out just while I was talking to two guys.
Okay.
And all of a sudden...
And is that stuff this... I mean, it's kind of awful that we need to use this as the example to...
Yes, it is.
Let's unpack your fecal matter erection.
But that is so unfiltered.
Yes, yes.
That is so unfiltered. I thought I could never admit that to a room full of people.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And now all of a sudden, because we have that trust, that love, that understanding, and every time a comic gets on stage, I think it was Mark Maron said, every time a comic gets on stage, he wants to be received. And so now, the fact that when I go to work, I mean, this has been so much fun. It's for the first time in years, I look forward to going to work every night. And I haven't felt that way in such a long time, except maybe when I'm touring internationally and like in a different country and it's a different culture. And then there's, you know, I've got the outsider thing. But now because there's that intimacy, I feel received before I even set foot on stage.
Are you able to take that with you into a room in a regular comedy club full of people who aren't there?
That's the next trick. But to be honest, I don't know. I don't know.
Do you want to? I mean, would you be happy doing the box
tour? I want to talk
forever?
To Robin Ince about it, because Robin Ince makes the same mistake I do, is that when he, I can see it, is the moment that he's in a room that he feels isn't his audience, he starts talking about his audience.
Okay.
And he goes, oh, well, you see, my audience likes this reference, rah, rah, rah. And, of course, the entire room goes, fuck you, we're your audience now. And I do that.
Yeah.
I completely self-sabotage. Or sometimes if I go to a comedy club and I see a comedian killing with stuff I don't respect the room, I start doing stuff I don't believe in and I don't sell it properly and I fucking suck. The amount of people in this industry that must be saying to people that come to see me personally going, that guy fucking sucks, right? And they're probably right because they've seen me be petulant in a room where I'm just, wah, I'm not immediately received and I just start throwing a tantrum and I ruin them. And I don't know how to get past it. And I think talking to Robin might help because I've seen Robin do the same thing. I've seen Robin in front of his audience and he's delightful, he's charming, he's engaging. And then all of a sudden he starts to talk to a room full of strangers and he just goes, I'm smarter than all of you. And I hear it. I hear him just going, I'm frightened. You aren't accepting me immediately. Wah, where's my room? And I do the exact same fucking thing.
That's really... thanks, man. That's yeah, I think you're... I think that's a really, what's the word, per something? Anyone help me?
Perceptive.
Perceptive, thanks. I was going to go with perspicacious. Total nonsense. Don't even know what it means. I think that's really perceptive. That idea of your petulance.
Yes.
And recognising that the petulance is the problem. Recognising that in a room full of people who are there to see you, you don't suffer from that and you're better and you have more fun and you look forward
to it. I mean, entirely, that's why I think for years people who have been fans... And they've, like, spoken to people on the internet or whatever, and they're going, this guy's fucking Jim Davidson. Like, I've actually had that comparison, staggeringly. And people are like, what? What are you talking about? But somewhere along the way, they've probably seen me in front of what I perceive to be the wrong crowd, and I was just a fucking prick.
So what of your... Which bits of your material from... gigs where you have had arm folders in, people that weren't your, you know, gigs over the last 25 years, whenever. What bits have been your proudest moments in terms of the writing? What bit are you most proud to have created? If we were talking about legacy earlier on, is there a particular bit that sticks out for you as, that's my, I did that, that I got everything out of that subject and I said exactly what I wanted to say?
Oh, why I don't use the N-word in public.
Okay. I don't know that bit. Which DVD is that from?
So that is from Thinking Man's Idiot, and I think it's on my US album as well, Pompously Lectures Americans. But that bit has grown now as well.
Okay.
But it's basically the subtext of the bit. The bit is, I think not saying nigger is a sneaky white trick.
Okay.
I think the only people that benefit from it are white people. Because you look at like, and it probably is going to grow more now, because you look at the Trayvon Martin case, right? And I think it's a booby prize. You know what I mean? Because I'm an Australian that does comedy in England. I'm not willing to patronise anyone. But we discussed this before, is I think that this society is built on more than any other, on who's more than and less than. And I think rather than changing our attitudes and treating one another as equals, we just go, oh, I just won't use that word. And then I'm done. Yeah. And then I'm done. Everything's fine. And I think it's a booby prize. And I think the Trayvon Martin case proved it better than anything, which I might revisit the bit, actually, because I wrote the bit before that happened, and then I was like, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Because do you know the Trayvon Martin case?
Yeah.
young black kid goes to the shops for Skittles, and there's a neighbourhood watch guy following him because he's a young black kid with a hoodie. And they get into a fight, and the guy starts to lose the fight because the black kid obviously goes, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you following me? Right? And they get into a fight, he starts to lose the fight, and he shoots him dead. And the guy got off scot-fucking-free. And you know why? Because he was on the phone, they had a recorded phone call, and his girlfriend called Zimmerman a cracker.
Right.
And then everyone went, whoa, whoa, it's all right when she says cracker, they made it racial. And then the fucking motherfucker got off. And I just think it's a very hard thing to explain comedically, so I won't even go into the whole bit, but I just say the fact of the matter is the notion of the bit is I'm not hanging out for my N-bomb day. You know what I mean? I'm not touching cloth. I'm not waiting for black people to say, you can say it now, and I'm going to run around singing it in the street. Because the bottom line is, by making that word taboo, no one's taking it from me. They're giving it to racists.
Okay.
And that's the point of the bit.
Okay. So when you're, so let's talk, when we've only got about 5 minutes left before we wrap up, but I want to just stay with this. And I know we can't go into detail on the bit here, but people listening to this...
It's all available on my back catalogue.
It's all available on the back catalogue, yeah. So I just want to talk then about the order in which that bit came together. Did you start off with the observation that we... Well, where did you start? What was the beginning of it? What have you... How did you add to it? Did you just add to it on stage? Did you add to it off stage? Were you...
The beginning was I crave black approval because all my influences are black comedians.
Okay.
My favourite comedians growing up were black American comics.
Sure.
So Flip Wilson, Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy. And to the extent where if you see, like Bill Burr does it as well. And so does Louis C.K. We all do it, all us guys in our 40s. We do that with our hands when we're talking. And it's because we want to be Richard Pryor. But unfortunately, I drink so much Monster, it depletes my testosterone. It does. It depletes your testosterone. And I've looked at the videos, and I don't look like a rapper. I look like a great big gay lobster. So, so I'm in my head, I really thought like I was like, yeah, you're feeling me? You're feeling me? But it really comes off more like, you didn't hear it from me. And so I really wanted to, you know how like white rappers feel that they won't really be rappers until they're accepted by the black community. Mm-hmm. I really want a black audience, right? And then I went to Africa and South Africa, and I started. oh, this is going to sound so pricky. How can I tell this anecdote without sounding like a cunt?
The conversation that is on ticker tape in Brendan's head 24/7.
Unless it's an audience and I don't know.
Yeah.
And then it's, how can I say this and sound like a cunt? I learned a lot going to Africa, and a lot of the black and coloured acts there. Coloured, by the way, there means mixed race. It's not a racial slur, to the extent where if you call a coloured person black, they get upset and vice versa, right? And a lot of the guys, they kind of said, because this was at the dawn of South African comedy and their comedy festival, and a lot of the guys said, look, we're glad you came here, we're glad you said what you did, but we're also glad you're leaving because you'd be dead in 3 months. And then I went to some gigs and started, like, saying people had said that, and they're going, ah, bullshit, what? And I was like, all right, how many people in this room have a gun? And, like, fucking half the room sticks their hand up, went, how many people in this room have been shot? The other fucking half stick their hand up. So once I started going to different environments and playing to black gigs, and the one thing I've learned traveling around the world is that it's something that we're not aware of here is if you do a black gig, you better have some jokes about black people. You know, thank you, right? Because otherwise you're fucking irrelevant, you know? And this whole idea of the thing that really bugs me in England about this supposed British sense of humour, what do they say every time? I think it's our ability to laugh at ourselves. Fuck you! Oh, thank you, Mazza. We're so glad the master race can laugh at yourselves, because the fact of the matter is, if you go to a Muslim country, Muslims love jokes about Muslims. You go to Australia, Australians love jokes about Australians. Everyone loves jokes about them. They just don't think it's fucking magnanimous.
Okay, yeah, okay.
You know what I mean? There's a real kind of like, oh, isn't it? And so here,
yeah,
it's almost...
They don't congratulate themselves.
Yeah, oh, well, themselves brilliant. Okay. Yeah, it's yeah. Like, I mean, Asians, you do Asian gigs, Asians love jokes about Asians. You go to these different countries and it's just, That's people, everyone has a sense of humor about themselves. They just don't think it's special. Mm. And so I started going in these environments, and I just, that's, I suppose, where the bit it came from is just about the fact that I'm not offended or outraged by the word, but I just thought, like, oh, this is actually a sneaky white trick.
So presumably, with such a contentious topic, you couldn't just walk on stage and just talk around the idea, or did you?
No.
Did you do some prep on that before?
You need to be half an hour in.
No, I mean, I see what you mean, but...
Before you can go there.
But what I mean is the first time you mentioned that, the first time you give an outing to that thought, half an hour into a gig, have you done any kind of written your bullet points out beforehand, or are you just walking on going, I'm just going to face plant into this?
No, that was written on a laptop.
Okay.
The first time I did it was written on a laptop, and it went from 5 to 20.
Okay.
I think.
And do you have any, when you're talking sort of about your writing more generally, do you have strategies to get you out of? I mean, do you ever have times? Here's me asking Brendan Burns. Do you ever have times when you don't have anything to say? But do you ever feel blocked, and do you ever need to get out of that? Or is there always, or do you ever feel tired of a particular trope? Do you ever go, oh, God, I can't do it today?
No. I think there's been times when I've wondered what I was going to do for a living. I think before this, I think if you asked me this 2 or 3 years ago, when, like, for the first time ever, I'd lost money in Edinburgh.
Right.
And I could see the cultural shift of the overexposure. And Patrice O'Neill, black American comic, always used to say to me, you know, you're 15 years behind me, motherfucker. Bearing in mind, he was dressed as a pimp at the time. But he used to always say British comedy hasn't, you know, it's in its boom period. America went through that in the 80s and the 90s was the downturn, which is why they've got such brilliant comics coming out of there now. Because the only people that got into comedy were people that had to do it or die, right? So your Patton Oswalt's, your Louis C.K.'s, your Bill Burr's, your Patrice O'Neill's, all those people did comedy because it saved lives, because it's they were born to do it and they had to do it. Whereas we've gone through that period where there's a lot of money in it. And, you know, you'll have a pretty young kid going, oh, this is my way into sitcom. This is my way into something else or whatever, right? So it starts to get a bit generic and everyone becomes a bit samey. And audiences turn up and expect to see what they see on television. Mm-hmm. And then when it's not what they see on television, they get upset. And then financially clubs start to suffer because they start kowtowing to people that complain. So you asked me this 2 or 3 years ago. I was seriously thinking, like, I got to get out of this fucking country because I see where this is going. And then, after talking to you, started doing the podcast thing, and then started, because we returned to the original point of there was 110 touring comedy shows this year, more than ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing horror stories of 400 seaters with 20 people in them.
Yeah.
And I thought, why compete with a comedy club's mailing list to have people come along? And it was a couple of punters that had come to see me at very reputable comedy clubs, but there was still a stag do in and someone passed out drunk, and then an ambulance had to be called, and people came up to me afterwards and said, I've been following you for years. I really wanted to hear what you've been working on. Yeah. And I just thought, let's fuck off. Let's just step outside, do what, like, David Cross, Doug Stanhope, Neil Hamburger did, and go to hidden locations, go to secret locations, and it's just you and me and you guys. And I don't think I've ever been happier. I think last year at the Free Fringe, I had a better time than even the year I won the Eddie. Because, and I mean, that's everyone's dream. Because that was the most, like, this sometimes shows have been selected, and other times there's kind of a clear winner. Like well, I don't mean as in from a vain point of view. What I mean is I was the bookie's favourite.
I understand.
In the first week.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It's like it was not me as a comic. It was right show, right time, right guy.
Yes.
Because it was apt in it. And so I just got lucky with the right show, right time, right guy. Although I'd always dreamed of that, and that's, you know, despite what every comic claims, that's everyone's dream to have that year.
And you felt, I mean, I heard at the time, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that you won and then you immediately rang up all the commercial clubs and pulled all your gigs in that you didn't want to play. Is that true?
No.
Nothing I hear about anyone is true. Forget it. Move on. that was a story on the circuit at the time.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I had a tour booked before the festival.
Okay.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, well...
I pulled on my clubs. No, I didn't do club dates because I was booked on a tour.
There's literally not one single time in 110 episodes I have said to someone, and you know everyone on the circuit thinks this, and they've gone, oh, that's true. Everyone has always gone, nope, bullshit, don't know what you're talking about.
Total bullshit. Yeah, 100%
okay.
Let's bullshit.
Get back to that point then, because we must wrap up. I'm sorry, we started late because of the tech.
So oh, okay. Shit, I've got to get to my show, don't I?
You do. It's, it's 7 minutes past.
7 minutes past? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Who's coming to my show?
Yeah!
Do you know where it is? Is it far? Is it walking distance? Okay, cool. I'll follow you guys. Okay.
He really does have a very one-to-one relationship.
Oh, yeah. It's zero fourth wall. Zero.
Just to finish this thought then, since discovering that you can find the audience yourself, get them yours, like you've been growing an audience for ages, but now you're cultivating that audience.
Yes.
And you are able to make that relationship with them, have jobs, have gigs that you enjoy more, to people who enjoy your stuff more. What's the next 10 years worth of that look like for you?
Well, remember how we discussed it last time? How we said that there are people in America who you've never heard of, mm-hmm. who make a great living mm-hmm. from just doing online 10, content.
10,000
real
fans.
And they don't have to... 10,000 true fans.
Yep.
That's all you need.
And is that... You're committing to that now? That's in depth. I mean, have you got any retirement
I don't want to be fucking famous.
Are you planning... How much more comedy do you think you've got in you? Have you got another 20 years?
Yeah.
Are you going to do it till you die?
I think... let's face it, come on. The amount of Monster I drink. Let's enjoy...
You're going to die quite soon. Yeah.
My death will not be slow. Let's just enjoy me while I'm here. It's, I even had to say that to my kid. It's too much Monster. And I went, yeah, but you know what? I'm not going to drag it out, son. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be there. And it's, you know what? It's only going to be the memory of what I was like, not the last fucking 5 years of... someone help my boner that's run by shit.
There is no finer point to leave it than there. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Mr. Brendan Burns.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you. Okay.
So that was Brendan Burns. What a lovely guy. Huge amount of fun. Sorry for some of the explicit content there. I might have warned you at the beginning. But you know what come to expect now. We're all grown-ups and are we all grown-ups? I'm not going to do a shout-out, get in touch if you're a child. Maybe some of you shouldn't be listening. There's naughty stuff on here. But I hope it is inspiring young people. What a Goldsmith answer that was. I just classically Goldsmith that. A thing occurred to me, and then I tried to make sure it was completely acceptable to everybody. Hideous. If you were listening to me freak out last time during the Lou Sanders conversation, good news. I managed to put that show together in a week. What an exhilarating process. I'll talk more about that at another time. But I had some lovely, lovely previews over the weekend. Thank you to everyone that came to my preview at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival over last weekend. And indeed, the Phoenix Fringe. Both of them brilliant, brilliant organisations, which afforded me really fun opportunities to try some really wonky stuff. But wonky, I think the audience of those shows would agree, just wonky in a really fun way. I think I'm getting increasingly wonky. I think that's good. I'm enjoying it. Thanks to Brendan. Thanks to everyone. If you're Rowdy Roddy Piper, if you are the human being Rowdy Roddy Piper, please tweet me. Don't text me. You can. Tweet me at ComComPod. Lots of love to all the wrestlers, all the drag queens, all the open spots, all the wannabes, all the artists, all the bakers, and all the candlestick thieves. I've been Stu Goldsmith. It's www.thebrendanburnsshow.com for all of those downloads. And, of course, for the download bundle, which I should have mentioned earlier, the download bundle, I think, is something like £20 or £24. You get 8 albums, loads of great stuff from Brendan. So go there in your droves and do that. I'll speak to you soon. Back next week with someone, a fun, unusual curveball. So we'll speak to you then.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.